As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, Scott Burnside back for another edition of Two Man Advantage, the hockey show, part of the Athletic Hockey Network. Pierre LeBrun, I'm worried about you, Pierre, because with the late starts in Vegas, I know you're doing half games, you get up early, we're taping the podcast, it's so exciting. We're going to have Jack Adams winner, Rod Vrindamore is going to join us later in the show, but I'm worried, how are you? Because you're burning the candle at both ends, and I know in your younger days that was part of your raison d'etre, but you're not as young as you used to be. How are you feeling?
5 hours sleep, but I got the caffeine going, and I'll slide in an afternoon nap when I need to, and keep an eye on the European Championship soccer games today, some big games.
Oh,
not that that's for work. I just tried to slide that in there to see if you were paying attention.
Because you know I'm a big soccer guy.
Right? Man, it's been a fun tournament.
Really?
Yeah.
Are the White Caps in it?
I'm not even gonna try with you.
In fact, I thought that was pretty good to come up with the White Caps on the on the spur of the moment. All right, listen. We're going to talk to Rod Vrindamore. Can't wait. But in the interim, speaking of Vegas, Montreal, I just absolutely loved your Corey Perry piece, and I talked to Corey for a story, which I haven't even written yet. We talked during the pandemic, and it was just before.
Well, it looks like you might have time now.
Yeah, no kidding. Anyway, it's that I'm not going down the rabbit hole of that. But anyway, he and I chatted during the pandemic, and it was, you know what? It was just before he ended up signing in Montreal, because he and I talked about, you know, what was going to happen, because it, you know, looked like a return to Dallas was going to be out of the question. And, you know, he's not a young man, and but I just watch him every night now, and it's just so impressive. And I loved your piece, and you talked to people who knew him so well, you know, Scott Niedermeyer and Bob Murray. And I wonder, so let's start with Corey Perry, but were there things that surprised you when you were doing the piece about how people view Corey Perry? Because, you know, listen, he's a guy that, you know, other teams don't particularly like all that much.
Yeah, he's a guy that you find hard to play against, but when he's on your team, you love him. And you know, it's interesting. Like Scott Niedermeyer, by the end of our phone call, Hall of Fame defenseman, he said, you know, he's played with sort of two guys like that you really, really appreciate having on your side and not playing against. And he said, Claude Lemieux and Corey Perry. Of course, from Niedermeyer from his Devils days with Claude Lemieux. And I think that's an apropos comparison. And you know, he was only in Dallas 1 year, and the eye-popping quote I got from Jim Neal, the Stars GM, is that he called Corey Perry one of his all-time favorite players. Yeah. All-time. You know? And I think it's just that that leadership and that passion for the game is so infectious in a locker room. And he just – Corey Perry's a guy that wills a group into the fight. And they got a few of those guys right now in Montreal, not just Corey Perry, but, you know, just – when I saw his bloodied face and welcoming his teammates after overtime Friday night in Game 3 against Vegas, I said, I got to do something on this guy. And I'm really happy with the way the piece turned out, because there's some interesting nuggets in there, like Pat Morris, the agent, revealing. I had heard that at the time, but revealing on the record that when Perry was on waivers early in the season, he phoned the three teams that he had a feeling might try to claim him and dissuaded them from doing that. And imagine if Perry's account in Montreal never really gets going because he gets claimed on waivers. That would have been pretty sad.
Yeah. Well, and it's a good way to segue into where we're at now. And I watched that game last night, Game 5. Of course, the Habs coming up with an incredible victory in a very difficult place to play in Vegas to take a 3-2 series lead. And there's none of... Like, if we were talking about the start of the series, well, Montreal might be ahead 3-2, and you would say, well, that's only if Carey Price stands on his head every single night, blah, blah, blah. You know what? I mean, Carey Price is really good in the third period. But listen, I think the Habs have been the better team, I would say, for, 65, 70% of the series. They have been the clear better team. I would not have predicted that.
It's fascinating. I mean, we talked about it before the series. I did think I had seen enough of them now that I thought the Habs would give Vegas a hard time. That's what I told you. But again, I was going to pick Vegas, you know, in 6 or 7. But all these people saying the North is about to get exposed, the Habs are going to get swept, that was nonsensical even before this series. I didn't need to watch them play another playoff game to know that they would absolutely give Vegas all they could handle. And that's another big message in all of this, regardless of how this series ends, even if Vegas comes back to win in 7.
Yeah.
The very tiresome conversation about how bad the North Division was, I think we can put that to bed. like it turns out that if teams don't play each other, you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know. And yeah, the games might have been more wide open and a lot of high-end offensive stars in the North, and the scores were often higher than the three U.S. divisions. It doesn't mean that it's a weak, you know. So let's just put that to bed. The Habs performance, I think, is that's one thing that it has done. But, you know, I thought Vegas was the better team early on in this series, and I think Montreal has been the better team really in Game 2, in Game 4, and in Game 5. I thought Vegas was better in Game 1 and in Game 3. And, of course, the interesting thing about that is Vegas lost Game 3 and won Game 4, but in terms of merit of play. And the series is based on merit. It's exactly where it should be, I think, 3-2.
Yeah, no kidding. And I think it's, you know, in the same way that we look at Colorado and understand that, you know, whatever, you know, their loss to Vegas may down the road galvanize them or be a learning experience. I know it's a bit of a trite thing to say when a good team gets beat out, but you know, I think we think that's the case with Colorado. You got to learn how to lose before you can win. This Vegas team, this has been a revelatory series, I think, because you can sense the frustration of their top end guys. I know Max Pacioretty scored a goal last night, but you know, Mark Stone, who never wants for effort, and I think he's been, he looks like he's doing all the right things, but cannot find the back of the net. And
had a great chance there last night.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Coming around, driving to the side of the net and couldn't get the stick on the puck. And anyway, I just think it's fascinating because, you know, this is a Vegas team that, you know, it should be, you know, it's built for this kind of series. And here they are. They need to win 2 in a row to advance to a final. I'm not sure they have it in them.
Well, it's interesting. In many ways, they're playing a mirror image of themselves, except that a lot of people didn't think the mirror image would stand up to them. They're both, you know, both the Habs and the Golden Knights want to grind you down and not be just about one line and terrific blue lines and all world goaltending. I mean, they're very similar, except that you just felt that clearly Vegas was more of an elite team. Well, that's obviously not playing out that way. And, you know, you talked about Colorado. I can't help but think if you're Joe Sakic and Chris McFarlane in it, and the Avs front office, that you're looking at that series. Now, you got to be careful not to knee jerk,
yeah,
because that's dangerous in this business too. But the way the Habs big four are shutting down Vegas's forwards, after the Habs big four shut down Wheeler, Kyle Connor, Nikolaj Ehlers, after they shut down Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner, boy, if you're Colorado and you've got this very talented blue line, but do you have enough beef on it? And I know as soon as that came out of my mouth, I know the analytics crowd is just going to want to come after me. Listen, I'm not on with either camp in all this. I'm all about data and eye test and merging all the ideas together. But yeah, the fact of the matter is what we've seen in these playoffs yet again, it's not like it's a new thing, by the way, but again, what we've seen in these playoffs is, you know, the game is played differently. The game is called differently. And if you got big dudes on the blue line that could take away time and space and get away with some of it, it's paramount at this time of year. And I don't know that the Avs have enough of that on their blue line, despite all the all-world talent that they have there. I don't know how you feel about it.
No, I think that, in fact, I got a mailbag thing coming up, and there are a number of questions about the Avs and what do you do. And I think, you know, part of it is, you know, listen, they really missed Eric Johnson on the back end, and
he would have been one of those guys. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But your point is well taken, and the proof is in how, and it's not just Montreal, although that, you know, those top four, man, they're going to be tired at the end of it, because Eric Gustafson's not seeing a lot of ice time for the Habs. And so there's a lot of load on those top four guys, but you know, who reminds me, you know, Tampa, once again, you know, look at the back end in Tampa, and look,
that's pretty beefy too, boy. Ooh, now, it helps when the best defenseman in the world happens to be both, you know, an offensive genius and a beefy defensive genius. I mean, Victor Hedman's the whole package, but the rest of that blue line, Ryan McDonagh,
oh yeah,
such a strong, physical, smart player. I mean, up and down, you know, a little beat up right now, but you're right. I mean, that's, and again, like, in many ways, Tampa is the model for Colorado more than any other team because of the all-world skill that the Lightning have, but the way in which they tweak that lineup to adjust to playoff hockey over the last couple of years.
Yeah, to your point then, and Colorado won't be the only team that looks at these playoffs and says, geez, are we big enough on the back end? You know, in the same way that Tampa asks themselves, are we big enough up front before they won the Cup last summer and may well win another one this summer. But it makes me wonder about a guy like David Savard, who, you know, again, you know, like he's not a flashy guy. And unless you're following the game closely, you might ask yourself, why do people care about David Savard at the trade deadline? Well, for the very reason that you've just outlined, a guy who can block shots and, you know, clear bodies and chew up 22 or 23 minutes a night if you need him to. And I think he's been really good in Tampa. And I don't know how that's going to play out. You know, as you and I are chatting, Bolts coming off that 8-0 whitewashing of the Islanders. Now, listen, never count Barry Trotz's teams out. So we'll see how it turns out. But yeah, it's going to be fascinating, because I have to believe, even in a flat cap era, that a guy like David Savard suddenly becomes, when GMs are like, let's see if we can fit a guy like that into our budget, because they see how important it is when it matters the most here in this playoff year.
But again, it's about balance. Like, you can't, you know,
can't have six of those guys.
Right. So it really, I mean, logic, I mean, you need a bit of everything is really the story here. And, you know, it's not like Montreal's just about beef. I mean, the first pass for Shea Weber and for Jeff Petrie is pretty damn accurate. Joel Edmondson, underrated. Joel Edmondson was the best defenseman on the ice for Montreal last night. His story continues to be, I mean, his acquisition last offseason was not welcomed by enamored Habs fans. It was not like, wow, what an acquisition. You know, it was like, what is this about? And you know, and listen, I can tell you, first of all, Habs assistant GM Scott Mellenby is based in St. Louis, would have seen Edmondson play a ton, especially during that cup run in 2019 with the Blues. You know, Kirk Muller, who was on the Habs coaching staff, of course, you know, would have known a young Edmondson from his time as a coach on the Blues coaching staff. And finally, this, as the story goes, Mark Bergevin was in the bubble watching about 3 hockey games a day in Toronto last summer at the start of that tournament, and kept watching Edmondson on Carolina, knowing that he was a pending UFA, and said, this guy would be the perfect, because the Habs, of course, last summer were basically playing 3D.
Yes.
and he, Bergevin, to his credit, looked at Joel Edmondson and said, imagine if I have him joining Weber, Sherratt, and Petrie. There's my big four.
Yep.
And again, what it was not a universally praised signing, but again, it was Mark Bergevin saying, come playoff time, these guys make a difference. And he's been proven right.
Yeah, there's no question. And Edmondson's game itself, there has been an evolution, right? I mean, you go back to that cup run in 19 for St. Louis, and I remember you and I were doing like player, you know, stock up, down, like after every game. And there were some moments where he, you know, it was hard for Joel Edmondson during mm-hmm. that playoff run in that group. But he has, I couldn't agree more. I think he's just been so important to what the Habs have done. And man, it's may not be over yet. So, well, it's definitely not over yet. They're going to play at least 2 more games, but it'll be interesting to see, you know, could be the, you know, part of that mix in sending a Canadian team to the final for the first time since 2011. And of course, last time Canadian Cup winning team in Montreal, 93. And this allows me the good segue before we get to Rod Brind'Amour to talk about Vancouver, the last Canadian team to make a final. An interesting move management-wise have been in the air for a while, but the Sedin brothers, Daniel and Henrik, mm-hmm. Formally joining the front office there as the special advisors to the GM. I just have to think that A, let's assume that their voice is going to be heard, and whatever their true mandate is, it is about bringing the truth and being candid and having a role. But I have to believe if that's the case, this is good news for a Vancouver team that, you know, really took a step back this season.
Yeah, I think it is. I love the promise of it. And you know, if you know anything about the Sedins, is they don't do anything halfway. I mean, they're going to put their heart and soul into this and be willing to be a fly on the wall, too, as they learn about it. And I think it's very much akin to me the way Steve Yzerman went into Red Wings University after his playing days and soaked it all in from Ken Holland and Jim Neal. I think that that's what the Sedins are going to try and do as they want to put their imprint on this organization. Now, on the flip side, and I hate being a cynic, the only thing that worries me is that we had a lot of warm feelings about Trevor Linden going back and running that franchise, given where Trevor Linden's place in Canucks history stands, and we know how that ended. So that's a that's a very unique market, extremely passionate, and you know, I would argue that the Sedins will have the kind of Teflon in that market that maybe no one else ever has in the history of the Canucks. So that'll help as they, again, try to get back in their winning ways here after being the team of the bubble last year. But I see no downside in this. I think that this is all positive and Canucks fans should be pretty excited.
Do you like it when I pump your tires about all the great stuff that you've written? But the piece that I really enjoyed, along with the Corey Perry piece, was yours. Yeah, we talked about stock up, stock down, and the playoffs, as they should, in my opinion, weigh heavily in a lot of factors, whether it's free agency. Mm-hmm. But coming into an Olympic season,
maybe. We hope.
Yeah. In fact, I reached out trying to get an update on it, and it was a long – I sent a long email, and it came back, no update. So yeah. I'm hopeful that, you know, again, we're hoping that there will be an Olympic tournament in 2022. But I thought your piece was interesting because these playoffs, you know, on a number of levels have been, you know, for some players, they've been really disappointing. And I think they will, especially for deep teams like Canada and the United States, you know, it could have an impact on whether a player, you know, where they fit into the picture as we head into next season. I'm wondering, did you hear from people after your piece, or were there surprises? Because people take these things very seriously, and I wonder what kind of fallout you there was.
Yeah, I did. I heard from a lot of Leaf fans, and it was interesting because, and again, this isn't like, I got to be careful how I say this. It's not like I'm just making this up. Like, obviously, you know, I understand that the Canadian management group is looking at the playoffs as a very important barometer as to how players perform in big games and what that means for these really difficult roster selections. Now, again, the rest is all on me, but knowing the background that Team Canada's Brain Trust is looking at these playoffs as a really important moment, especially in a shortened season, by the way, there's no question that, you know, Mitch Marner, for example, who might have been almost a lock before the playoffs to make the Olympic team for Canada, is now more of an open question. Now, I personally would still put him on the team because I think it's a team so full of centers playing out of position that when you have a natural winger like him that is so talented that I would make room for him, kills penalties, does it all. But you can't argue with the fact that he's now gone, you know, two playoff years in a row without a goal, and that would raise eyebrows within the Canadian Brain Trust. It's just, it is what it is. And now the point I was going to make is that, interestingly, I also wondered whether Morgan Riley's stock had gone down. The interesting feedback I got from a lot of Leaf fans was that they actually agreed with my Marner assessment, but would disagree with the Riley one.
Interesting.
And it's true. I thought Morgan Riley was good in the first round against Montreal, but he kind of, unfortunately, you get swept under sometimes with this perception now that the Leafs haven't been able to step up come playoff time for a number of years, and he's been there for a number of years. So, again, unfair probably. And again, if I'm putting Team Canada together, Morgan Riley is among my choices on the left side. But the idea of the piece was stock up, stock down. And I think if you're a Leaf, your stock is down. Now, does that affect Austin Matthews for Team USA? No, it does not. But you know, and so that kind of thing, you know, going on and on with other players in the playoffs too. The playoffs loom large.
Good stuff. All right. Excellent stuff, my friend.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
As promised, joined by Rod Brind'Amour, head coach of the Carolina Hurricanes. As of last week or so, the Jack Adams Trophy winner is Coach of the Year. And Rod, right off the hop, hey, thanks for coming to hang out with us. But I'm wondering if you are seeing an immediate response to your Jack Adams win with that U10 team that you're volunteering with. Have they responded to your award with better play yet? Because I gotta hope they will.
That's a good. That's you would think so, but we were on the ice last night and. I mean, if there's any indication, then it certainly didn't pay off. My son was just terrible out there. I said, "What are you doing, man? Are you wasting my time out here?" Hopefully it catches on, but so far not very good.
Now, Rod, I'm surprised that you're willing to do this podcast, because when I think back, Scotty did a big article on you, I think about 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. I forget when he spent time in Carolina, wrote a story.
I'm there all the time.
And he quoted you saying, because eventually your contract was going to be up, and he quoted you saying, "Well, it's not like I'm going to go coach anywhere else," or something to that effect. I mean, really, you should never be talking to Scotty again. That is not negotiating 101, Rod.
I know. Listen, trust me. I've heard it from everybody on how not to negotiate a deal here. But Pierre, Scotty's been one of us, man. We've gone back. He's been, feel like you, I've seen him, like you said, you've been down here a lot, been in our room. And you know what? Part of the reason that's easy to say yes to do and stuff like this, because he's a good dude. Scotty, Pierre, you guys are good dudes. It makes it fun to talk to you guys, and so that's why we're here.
Well, that's see. We're just going to continue to talk about how much you like Pierre and I. We're going to fill up the 20 minutes or so with that. But no, Pierre sort of joked about your new contract, and it was a top discussion or a hot topic around the hockey world. What was going to happen to you? Whether you were going to stay in Carolina, and you've had a lot going on, right? I mean, you win the Jack Adams, you sign a new deal. The Hurricanes. Lose to Tampa in 5 games in the second round. What's it been like for you to process all that's happened to you in the last 2 or 3 weeks? Because there's a lot of stuff going on.
There was, just starting with the most important thing, the losing was the hard part. I mean, we wanted to do better, and I don't get caught up in, you got lost in the second round or the first round. Like, to me, last year we lost in the first round, but we were – technically, I thought that was the second round because we had to have a playoff to get in. I don't really understand that. But then we hit, Boston, which they were the best team in the regular season, So you lose. We hit one of the top teams, and there's no different than this time. Second round in, we're playing one of the best teams. So I don't look at it that way. I look at, okay, where could we, how far away are we from beating these guys? And then I look at it, and it's clear we weren't quite there. But – it's not as bad as, you lost in 5 games, because 2 of those games I thought were in our hands. And even the one we lost when we were up 4-2, like we were in position to win. Now, how do you get over that hump? And that's where the experience comes. And that's where Tampa's got us a little bit. So we got to learn from that. And, all the other stuff was going to take care of itself. You're talking about a contract. Like, to me, that was going to resolve itself one way or another. Obviously it did. And, now we're really just focused on this team this summer. How do we get better? Like, how do we get that little bit better so we don't have this conversation again next year?
Well, and I think what's special about all of this for you, Rod, is how ingrained you are in that community and that organization. Because I just never thought for a second that you were going to leave, even though the whole thing certainly probably dragged out longer than you would have liked. But it's just, can you put into words how, yeah. I mean, to me, you're the heart and soul of that organization. And
I don't know about that. What I know is, here's the thing. I feel like I'm one of the, I think I said this somewhere, but one of the richest coaches in the league, and not because they pay me the most. That's not how it is. But I don't know too many coaches that get to work where they live for the team that, they've kind of had a footprint in putting together, and then gets to do it, like I said, with a bunch of guys that I've been around forever. I don't know what you want to put a value on that for, and my, like you talk about, for then do all the extra stuff. My family's from here, and the roots they have. And it's just, I don't know any coaches that have what I have in that regard. And so, they may make a lot more money, but that's, I guess, I don't know. Well, that's not the most important thing. And trust me now, I feel like I'm the richest coach in the league.
Well, and if I can follow up, not to put too fine a point on it, because, sometimes it's uncomfortable talking about money all the time. But, the other part, unlike you and a lot of other head coaches in the league, and just to be fair to all of this, is that you played in the league a long time and made some money. Like, most coaches don't have that background, or a lot of them. Like, this is... they're having to fight tooth and nail, as they should, by the way, for their compensation. And you have a different background. Is that fair? I mean, that's part of it too.
I mean, that is fair for sure. But like I said, I think the most important, and there's another issue that I don't know how other coaches relate to owners and GMs, but Tom, like I have a great relationship with him and building our team and putting our pieces together. And, I feel like every step of the way we're talking about, everything. And mm-hmm. Tom doesn't pull a trigger or Don without saying, hey, what do you think about this? Or, and I don't know if the other coaches have all that, but, that's special too.
Yeah, no question.
We were talking, Rod, just before we started the tape, and you're wearing the NC State hat, a little College World Series going on. But you talk about your family, and your in-laws they come from an athletic background. Your father-in-law is a longtime player and coach. And I wonder, and I know that you have not just a close relationship, but you talk about the art or the craft of coaching and athletics and all those kinds of things. And I wonder if what kinds of lessons maybe you've learned from talking and spending time with your father-in-law and his experiences. And are you able to apply some of those to what you've learned in your experiences as a coach in Carolina?
Totally. So my father-in-law, like I said, he's coached college basketball forever. He actually played with Wilt Chamberlain back in the day.
Wow.
For a small time. So he's got some great stories that he doesn't tell me, some of them. So I just can only guess, but the coaching part of it has been great. Just the crossover, you know, we would talk a lot and he was more questioning me on stuff, but it's amazing, you know, little key phrases that use in basketball that, you know, you can relate to in hockey. And, you know, it's 5-on-5 in basketball. There's a lot of things going on when they do picks and they're doing all this stuff that you watch in hockey, it's happening all the time. So the sports, they cross over, but more importantly, how you relate to the players, right? Like the things you talk to, that's universal. And dealing with, he was dealing with college athletes, and I basically deal with that age group too in a lot of ways. So we definitely had a lot of good conversations on that stuff. And, you know, in my time here, I was thinking about this basketball. It's such an influence down here in North Carolina. I've become great friends with the former NC State coach, Sidney Lowe. He's now moved on and he's coaching in the NBA and an assistant, but we chat up quite a bit too on this kind of stuff. So it is, you know what, it's sports is sports, right? It's all about dealing with your athletes and doesn't really matter which one.
You know, Rod, a couple of weeks ago, we had Dave Tippett on this podcast and really gracious of him to join us about a week after they were knocked out in the first round. And he said some really interesting things about, you know, why was Montreal, you know, playing so well, and, you know, what did Winnipeg do to beat his team? And essentially, Scott, you can remind me if I got this right, but in a nutshell, he talked about playoff hockey and how different it is than regular season hockey and the lessons learned and, you know, the different grind. Like, I feel your team is learning those lessons every time you get a crack at it here. But how would you put into words, you know, especially as Montreal continues its run, but that it is a different season and a different style and how players have to adapt to that. How would you put that into words?
Yeah, it is 100% that. It is two different seasons. And the regular season should be maybe, I don't know how you can put more weight on it, because it is an 82 or 56 crammed in. Like, that's a big deal to play well that whole time and really get nothing for it at the end of the day. If you get in, that's all you have to do. Really, there's somehow I feel, because it's 6 months of, you know, every day trying to get better and pushing your guys and, you know, and then at the end of it, really all you have to do is get in.
Right.
Once you get in, all that goes out the window. And really all we get out of it is a game 7 home ice advantage if you get to it in a lot of ways. So, you know, as a coach, I'm always thinking, how hard do you really want to push? You know, because you got to have some more juice in the tank, or you got to have something. You certainly have to be healthy, you know, but you can't come off the gas, because there's only really one way to do that. Otherwise you won't even get in the playoffs, because it's such a fine line. You know, so I think from my standpoint, I probably still have to learn. Maybe when we were in, we had 10, 11 games left in the season, we were in the playoffs and a 56 game schedule, maybe should I have backed off a little there, but man, we were still playing for first, you know, like there was just so many, what's the advantage? Then we go in to start the playoffs and Jacob Slavin gets hurt in the last game of the regular season. And now all of a sudden, whoa, you know, that's a big loss. And we got through the round, but not, you know, it was getting dicey. And then because he had to come back kind of half beat up. So, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that when you hit the playoffs, you got to be healthy. You got to have your full team, because once you eliminate 16 teams, everybody's tight. I mean, it is good. You know, when you get down to the straws of it, you got to have your full group if you're going to win. I mean, to me, you look at Tampa, they added Kucherov, right? Yes. Like, they were already good. Really? And then added the best, maybe the best player in the game. Now, if you've got a guy that's out, like we didn't have Nino Ryder or Trocheck, suddenly they added the best player. We just took out two of our guys. Holy moly. That's a big deal. You know, it just is. I mean, over a 7-game series, that's going to come up somewhere. And obviously it did with us on the power play alone. Like, I mean, we took too many penalties and boom, that's the difference in the whole series. And I'm watching the Islanders play them now. What's the difference? The games are tight, tight, tight. The other night they get 6 power plays, boom, 3, you know, just, you can almost look at it, the other two games that they won, they took one penalty, right? Like, it's such a fine line. And the Islanders are, you know, scrap that last game to me. That's an easy game to recover from. But, you know, they won't take six penalties, you know, in the next game. I guarantee it. And the game's going to be tighter. So so I don't know if I'm answering your question, but
No, it's fascinating what you're saying, Rod. But also the part, like, because you thrived as a player of raising your game at playoff time, and I'm just wondering how different the game becomes, especially for skilled players, where, you know, it's tougher to earn your ice and it's more of a grind and it's more physical. I mean, that part of it, you're right. I mean, that's
a different game, but it's not. See, I always thought, everyone said, you know, you raised your game in the playoffs. I really didn't. I just played the same. Like, my game didn't change. And I think some guys, you know, their game is a little, maybe it's on the outside during the regular season. Maybe it's a little less, you know, direct and playoffs, all of a sudden everybody's playing hard, like every shift. It's not some shifts, it's every shift. And you know, if you don't have that already in you, it's harder, right? I think in the playoff time, and that, and especially the first couple rounds. I really believe this, the Stanley Cup, you don't win it in the first round, but you can certainly obviously lose it. Like, that's when everyone's playing their best. That first round sometimes is the hardest round to get through. And you know, I because everyone's so energized, usually everybody's healthy. And then even now you start watching it. If you look at the first round to this round, the intensity of it is still there, but it's not as physical. Like, things are starting to wind down a little because of attrition. Right. And those teams that get that kind of understand, hey, this is how it goes. They're the, you know, Tampas of the world. They understand how that works.
So it's funny you say that. I just last night watching Vegas Montreal, I was like, you know what? This is less physical than it was early. It's more tactical now at this point. It's like survival.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was lucky. I sat in on your very first meeting with your team after you took over as head coach in the fall of 18, right? And I remember part of your message. I mean, the Canes had missed the playoffs for 10 years, 9 or 10 years. And so your message was, okay, let's not stop playing hockey in April, right? I mean, our goal is to be a team that, you know, that's when it starts for us. And you've done that now. And I wonder what the challenge for you is, because the expectations are different now. This is a Canes team that should be in the playoffs, I think, every year, right? You're that good. And I wonder what the challenge for you is to take that message then to another level and say, okay, do you have to coach differently? How do you do that? Because you sort of achieved what you set out to do in that very first meeting in some ways.
In some ways. But the other part of that meeting was, you know, was, okay, we want to be relevant, but we want to be the best.
Yeah.
So the easy thing is, okay, well, clearly we're not that. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. So, you know, we still have that to go. And I what I like about it, I think it's amazing how setting the standard or the goals or whatever you want to call it, the expectations, if you just, and it doesn't have to be hockey and anything, you raise it on everyone. Suddenly now we don't talk about making playoff. Yeah. We're not talking about, you know, oh, let's squeak in and be, no, we're talking about trying to be the best team. So the playoffs are off the table now. And all we did is just say, let's raise the bar a little bit around here. And, you know, I think we do have a good team. So we can legitimately say it. It's hard if you know the guys know we're not that good. That makes it a little bit harder. But we know we've got the talent. We've got some good players here. And I think the carrot is still we got to win. I mean, that's all that's left here for us to do. And that's – I mean, it's not going to be easy, obviously, but that's what we're all about.
When you see Eric Staal score a goal, and I think about, you know, the connection, you know, he was a boy – really sort of coming into his own that first year in 05, 06 when you guys won the cup and you were the captain of that team. And I wonder what, you know, when is it hard to sort of, you know, sort of reconcile the two, the passage of time? There he is. He's still out there and he's now one win away from going back to a Stanley Cup final. I wonder what it's like for you to see a guy like Eric have that success. And of course, you know, Jordan being the captain and knowing the Saul family as well as you do.
Well, it's great. I'll be honest. And I obviously Eric and I are, you know, go way back, like you said, great, great relationship. Talked to him a lot, you know, over the year. And even this year was a tough year for him. And, you know, going back to getting traded, you know, to Buffalo, I mean, there's a backstory there too. Like the minute it happened, you know, I called him. I was like, because I knew it was going to be tough on him.
Yeah.
You know, he just kind of settled roots. Okay, I'm going to, in his mind, was like, I'm going to stay in Mini, and this is how it's going to go. I got my fan, blah, blah, blah. And then now he's, you know, jettisoned out of there and COVID, right? So couldn't see his kids all year. Like, it was going to be a tough year for him. And I just kept telling him, you got to hang in there. So, you know, it's going to be the best thing for you. If the team Mini didn't want you, that would have been bad. You would not have had a good time there. This is an opportunity. And it didn't really work out, right? And Buffalo was like, oh boy, disaster. And then, but you know what? Good things happen to good people, right? Like, now it's flipped. And obviously here he is getting a chance, like you said, to potentially, you know, go on to the chance for the Stanley Cup. So couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Number one, you said the family is phenomenal. So real happy for him.
Yeah. Last question I would have for you, Rod. And I know that normally I wouldn't ask this to a coach, but you are very involved in what happens in terms of roster construction. But how hard is it for you as a head coach to separate at times, you know, the business of the cap and how the team gets built? And what I'm getting to is obviously Dougie Hamilton has a big decision to make here eventually. You know, he's been so good for you guys in Carolina. Obviously, I know what you would like to see happen, but how do you approach that in terms of understanding that it has to play out?
Right. Well, it's tough and it's not tough because it's not tough because, you know, I have my voice. We talk about it all the time. You know, obviously we want him back, but I also understand that it has to fit, right? Like you just, there's a number on everybody. And if you overdo it, how are you going to have a good team? You know, and we have to be, you know, cognizant of that. I mean, it's can't overpay Dougie or because we're not going to be able to fill the other holes. Like we've got some holes we got to fill and otherwise the boat just keeps leaking, you know, like it doesn't work. And so I am aware of that. So I think where my influence comes in is more, okay, do we want the player? Yes. Okay. Now what's your offer? You know, it's gotta be fair. It's gotta be, you can't just throw a number out there and think that that's going to get the guy. But if the offers are, you know, fair, if they're reasonable, then I kind of step out of it. Like, I think we've done what we can. Now we got to let it, like you said, let it play out. And that's kind of where I think this is going to end up going or taking shape. I think that's what's going to happen here. So hopefully we get him back. But we also, I mean, I'm realistic. You know, I understand how it works.
Yeah. One for me before we let you go. You don't strike me, Rod, as a decompressing guy. But I wonder if you've learned since becoming the head coach, you know, how to take your time in the off season. And I wonder what the rest of the time, and it's going to be short, obviously, between now and the start of training camp and third week of September, whatever it is. What's the summer look like for you? And how do you, you know, prepare for what comes next?
Well, it's a double-edged sword a little bit because I've never decompressed really. When I played, I was never took time off, and because I always feel like, you know, somebody's getting better, right? Like you got to keep at it. And same thing with coaching, where I know I have to get better. So how can I turn it off and be getting better? But also knowing that you do need to get away from it to be fresh. So there's this, you know, that's what I struggle with all the time. So I don't know. I know that what I'll end up doing is probably just keep plowing through, you know, just because I won't feel like I'm missing something. I don't know. I'm like I say, this is my home. So I'm here every day. I'll run into the rink usually every day. See my video coach. We go at stuff all the time and then I'm home, you know? I'm getting both. I think I'm covering both. Some point my wife's going to lose her mind and go, we have to do something, you know, we have to take little Brooke somewhere and do something and we'll fit it in. But I don't know when that is going to be because the calendar is what it is. It just seems to be something pressing all the time. So I have to figure that part out.
Yeah. Going to be the shortest off season ever for everyone. That's for sure.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be tough for these teams that are still playing mentally. Like it is for sure.
Good stuff. Well, Rod, it's always great to catch up with you and appreciate your time and hanging out with us. Always great. And look forward to my next trip to Raleigh and we'll see each other in person. And
look anytime. Forward to it. I appreciate it, guys. Take care.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rod.
Okay. Enjoy the show.
Always good to catch up with Rod, my friend. And so here's what I want to ask you. I was thinking about this as Rod was chatting. And, you know, last week we were talking about, you know, a Canadian Olympic team. We were watching Carey Price and Marc-Andre Fleury going toe-to-toe, and maybe they're the 1-2 goalies for Canada. Again, assuming there will be Olympics in 2022. I'm curious what you think, because I think John Cooper's a guy, obviously, with Tampa. You got Barry Trotz, Pete DeBoer, you know, has a history with Hockey Canada as well. I got to think at some point, Rod Brind'Amour, even though he's not part of that Hockey Canada, that's not where he comes from, really, in terms of his coaching. But I wonder if there's a place for him on that Canadian coaching staff, because, I just wonder, because to me, it would be a natural fit to have a guy with that kind of enthusiasm, but a lot of good coaches that Doug Armstrong's going to have to choose from.
Yeah, so, as I speculated in that piece last weekend, I do believe John Cooper will be the head coach of the Olympic team for Canada. I don't know if that decision's been made yet, but that's, that's who's going to get it. And that's amongst a lot of great choices. And then I think if it's like the way they used to do it with Mike Babcock, I think they'll let John Cooper sort of have a feel for who he wants to assemble himself with on that staff. And so, does he reach out to a Barry Trotz or to a Gerard Gallant or to a Rob Brind'Amour? I mean, it'll be interesting to see how he decides to fill that out, if indeed I'm right and he's the guy. So, and to your point, one of the things that normally before you start getting calls for these assignments for Team Canada is you start to go to the Worlds, right? Do some World Championships and so on. But, I don't know whose stock has risen more in the last 2 years as a head coach than Rob Brind'Amour. I mean, that's why he's such a humble guy that maybe he just is uncomfortable talking about it. But it would have been a free-for-all had he gone the free agency, to be quite honest. Like, yes, it's just sure. Like, there are teams that have coaches that may have wanted to talk to him. but again, I think he eloquently talked about his roots and why that was just never going to be an option for him. And I don't blame him.
I could not agree more, my friend.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Building a portfolio with Fidelity Basket Portfolios is kind of like making a sandwich. It's as simple as picking your stocks and ETFs, sort of like your meats and other toppings, and managing it as one big juicy investment. Now that's pretty good. Learn more at fidelity.com/baskets. Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
All right, my friend, here we go. Just about to wrap up this edition of Two Man Advantage. Got some questions, a little Ask the Dorks. This is interesting, and there were a number of questions that surrounded officiating in the playoffs in general. And I thought it was interesting because I know you're a guy who stays away from, sort of wading into your sort of knee-jerk reaction to calls missed and stuff like that. But even you tweeted the other night. It was rare of you. And I thought it was interesting because you also tweeted that it looks like Kelly Sutherland and Eric Furlatt, who I thought did a marvelous job in game five, really calling the game properly. I love that part of it. And they may end up doing game six as well, which I think is a good thing. But, there were a number of questions. This is one from The Cause. Do you think the NHL will seriously look at the officiating in this year's playoffs and admit there needs to be some changes? Or do you think that there is a feeling that this is all right? And I guess that's the bigger question. It's not, did you miss a high stick on Corey Perry, which they did? But the greater issue of what's the mandate? What do you want this game to look like in the playoffs? And I wonder if you think, because it hasn't been a great spring, I don't think, in terms of overall level of officiating in the playoffs.
Yeah, so I want to separate my comment from the other night from the overall playoffs, because there are two different feelings for me.
Chip?
I would tell you that the overall playoffs, I don't think it's any different than any other year. I think there's a recency bias. I think social media exacerbates it. I completely mangled that word.
Oh, exacerbates. You did well. Yeah. You're in it.
You can tell I had 5 hours sleep. Every year there are some flashpoints, and obviously they have come for the most part over the past week, although there have been different flashpoints throughout these playoffs. But I don't think it's any different than any other year. But I think there are ways and platforms where people's feelings about officiating has been able to be, you know, disseminated in a different way than we used to. So honestly, I truly believe that. And that goes for a lot of different things in society, by the way. But certainly, Game 3 and in particular Game 4 of that Vegas-Montreal series, for both teams, by the way, which I stated in my tweet,
yeah.
I just think that there's got to be a line where, you know, a high stick to the face and a punch to the head and a cross check in the back, like, those are still penalties. I get that the line changes in the playoffs, that you allow the grind of it to happen. That actually doesn't bother me, or maybe it's just that I'm used to it. But there are some penalties that have to be called, and that was, frankly, a disaster in Game 4. So, but I'm not saying that that's what the entire playoffs have been. I think that's an exaggeration. I think people are overreaching. And I don't want to sound like the old guy, but I think we have a lot of younger members of the media, too, that are covering the game that have a lot less, you know, body of work to work with to compare all this. And I think they forget, like, there have been flashpoints of officiating forever. I mean, we go back to Jim Schoenfeld, Schoenfeld episode years ago. But my point is, it's not, you know, Carey Fraser in the Battle of Quebec. There have been all kinds of different things over the years, and I think you just have to calm down. And I don't buy that the officiating is worse today than it was 10 years ago. I personally don't buy that. I just think, like players at playoff time, like players have good nights and bad nights, and we hammer players when they have their bad nights. The officials have some bad nights too, and that was particularly bad.
I'm not sure I agree entirely, I just think there has to be an acknowledgement, which the league is loath to do, right? The league is they don't like to admit that they make mistakes or that their people make mistakes. They don't like to do that. And I think, you know, maybe it's time. I wrote this after, I wrote this earlier, but maybe, you know, what would be wrong with having sort of an officials summit? Listen, the NHL, behind the scenes, they do a lot to try and open. It's hard. It's hard to get good officials, and it's hard to train and develop them because the game has never been harder. People get hammered, you know, all the way down the line. Youth hockey, travel hockey, it's a terrible job because of social media and the parents, and it's hard to get good people, and the NHL works hard to open those doors. They do a great, it's a camp where they basically reach out to players, men and women, who have played at a high level but aren't playing the game anymore, but maybe they're interested in becoming official. So they've tried to cast a wider net.
That's a good point.
But maybe they're, you know, it's, I think it's okay to acknowledge, hey, maybe we need to do better, especially given social media. But anyway.
Well, anyway, and I mean, normally Gary Bettman, the NHL commissioner, does a State of the Union address at the Stanley Cup final. You know, now we're in the Zoom world, and who knows what that's going to look like. But presumably, if he does it again, then no doubt he'll be asked about it. He has to be.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see whether he's willing to go down that road or not.
Yeah.
But it's also worth pointing out, and you know, this is a delicate thing to talk about. Officials hate when you start getting into individuals and so on, but arguably the best two refs in the game aren't even available right now. So Wes McCauley's been out for a bit here, and now there is a potential of him maybe coming back for the Cup final. That's not for sure, but the potential. And, you know, I think he's well-regarded. And then, you know, Chris Rooney, this hasn't been talked about a lot, but Chris Rooney was in a bunch of Stanley Cup finals, right, the last several years.
Yes.
He's been out since March with the rotator cuff surgery, I believe. And basically his year was shut down.
Yeah.
So, you know, right now in this round, no McCauley, no Rooney. That's not nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, those are usually two of the guys that get called on all the time at this time of year.
Yeah. Okay, a couple more questions. It's a couple on Jack Eichel. Very interesting. And I know you touched on him in one of your rumbling columns not too long ago. There was one specifically from Ton Squad 42 about the Minnesota Wild. But I want to broaden it because this one from Robert at Rebels Anonymous wants to know what teams have both the financial capability as well as the future assets to even make an Eichel deal? And it doesn't seem like there are a lot of teams that would qualify on both fronts. And I know you've touched on this a number of times, but I think it bears repeating because it does seem like the talks about a potential move for Jack Eichel out of Buffalo, they aren't going away. And as we get closer, we're a month out from the expansion draft now. To me, and I think you've mentioned this, but the Los Angeles Kings would be one of those teams. But I think it's fair, right? There aren't a lot of teams that can step to the table and make a deal like this happen.
Well, first of all, I think it's 99% that Jack Eichel gets dealt this offseason.
Yeah,
okay. I just think that's a divorce that needs to happen for both sides. And as I wrote last week, the conversations have really taken a next level step between the Sabres and other teams. Now, beyond that, you've got to be careful because now we're getting into what we're hearing. And certainly Minnesota is involved, LA, I think Anaheim to some degree. Columbus has the 3 first round picks, but I don't know that they're willing to overpay at this point, given their own issues. Like they have to trade Seth Jones probably. Who else am I missing? He still makes sense for the Rangers, even though David Quinn's not there anymore, but he still makes sense down the middle for the Rangers. And then there's other teams, but certainly one of the things that I'm picking up on as I try to poke away at it is that I think Sabres GM Kevin Adams and his conversations with teams so far has really gone the futures route, which is not insignificant. Because one of the things I was wondering about in a Jack Eichel deal is whether the Sabres would simply try to get pieces for now and kickstart this in a hurry, or are they willing to use this trade to do yet another reset, which, by the way, might be the best route, despite the pain of it for that market. And I think from what I'm hearing so far is that it smells like a reset. That it does smell like the Sabres are asking for, the top prospect or two from each organization plus a first round pick. And that's the type of conversation that's happening right now, which is interesting because that's significant.
All right, one more. We'll do this from Gundam Reed. And who's the most interesting free agent in this offseason? And there are a bunch. There's a lot of interesting names out there.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you who I think it is, and only because, of course, their magical playoff run right now. And I was talking about this off-air with my TSN colleagues, Dave Pullen and James Duffy, last night at TSN. What is Philip Deneau worth?
I was just going to say him. Honestly, it's true. That was my name. Yes.
It's so intriguing to me. He might be one of the most unique players in the NHL right now that there isn't a lot of offense there in his game these days. There was a bit more before when him and Gallagher and Tatar the last few years were the dominant line for the Habs. But now that Suzuki and Kotkaniemi have developed, he really has become that shutdown center. Fewer offensive opportunities for him, but an unbelievable defensive center. Like he's shutting down guys left and right in these playoffs again. But what is that worth in today's NHL economy? I'm fascinated by what happens there. I think, despite the fact that contract talks broke off last fall between the Habs and Deneau and it felt like the end, I'm guessing this playoff run will at least invite another effort there for the Habs and Deneau. But if not, if he does go to market, I'm going to be so intrigued by what the analytics in every front office are telling their GMs that this guy is worth, because there's got to be some worth. This is going to sound like an idiot when I say this, but the guy doesn't produce a lot of offense, but he takes a goal off the board every night from the top players in the world.
Right.
So what is that number? Is it 4 million a year? 5 million a year? I don't know. It's fascinating to me.
Yeah. Well, and especially because it sounds, and correct me if I'm wrong, whether you reported this, but I know there were reports that he had turned down an offer before the start of last season. And Yeah, and you're right, because it is hard to get your arms around, because he's not a Mark Stone or an Alexander Barkov. I'm thinking of the Selke, you know, the guys at the top of the Selke list. He's not that guy. But oh my gosh, I mean, there is no way to quantify, I don't think, his value to Montreal. He takes virtually every single defensive zone draw, and he almost, well, and he didn't win them all, but he is an integral part to a team one win away from going to the Stanley Cup final.
So. Is he ever? And you know, he's actually now found, and I think it took him a while last year to understand where this was all headed or accept where this was all headed, but he's where he should be on a good team. Like,
yeah.
Suzuki now is the number one offensive center for this team. Kotkaniemi is developing into a fine two, but Deneau still plays huge minutes, so I hate to even call him a three, but he's not getting the his offensive role is no longer there. Yeah. And so, you know, but it's working out great because matchup wise now you're like, I think when Deneau was the number one center on that team, that's when you knew that team wasn't very good, to be very right. plain.
Yeah,
and
no,
so
for sure.
It is interesting. And by the way, the report was actually from La Presse in the off season that according, you know, to La Presse that he had turned down a long-term offer of $5 million a year. Mm-hmm. Now I will tell you that has never been confirmed to me from either side, but I certainly trust the reporting. So, you know, he was coming off a decent offensive year from last year, again, when his role was different.
Yeah.
So, you know, is $5 million a year still there? I honestly don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah. All right, just before we go, I just want to take a moment and acknowledge the passing of Tom Curvers before we wrap up here. And I know... you know, you and I both crossed paths with Tom over the years and can't think of a better person. And it's just sad, man. Just so sad. And I met Tom. The very first time I met Tom was when Wayne Gretzky was coaching the Coyotes and Tom was with the Coyotes organization. And I ended up at Mike Barnett's house. He was the GM at the time. And, or one of the executives with the Coyotes. I think he was a GM. And Tom was there and that started some, you know, we talked many, many times, Pierre. And often we would talk about things completely unrelated to hockey. We talked about books, shows we were watching. And then, of course, we talked some hockey. But anyway, good man. And I feel so badly for his family. So
that was heartbreaking. And fuck cancer, if I don't mind saying that. I used to love running into Tom in NHL press boxes and picking his brain about different articles I was thinking of writing. And he had a great vantage point about whether he thought I was off base or not. And just thoughtful human being. And that was sad.
Yeah. All right. Good thought for Tom and his family on this day. And then what else we got going on? John Vogel, speaking to the Buffalo Sabres of The Athletic, joins Craig Custance and Sean Gentile on The Athletic Hockey Show. What else we got here? 5 days a week, The Athletic Hockey Show. Mondays with Ian Mendez and Haley Salvian. Tuesday, Craig Custance, Sean Gentile. Wednesday, well, you know that. That's you and I, my friend. Thursday, Ian Mendez and Down Goes Brown. I love that. Friday, the Prospect Series with Max Boltman and Corey Promen. That's a new show. That's really good. Yes, very. Check out our comments section for each podcast episode at The Athletic app and rate and subscribe to The Athletic Hockey Show on Apple. If you aren't already a subscriber, go to theathletic.com/hockeyshow and receive a subscription for $3.99 a month. Pierre, that was great. Just really fun, as always, to catch up with you, my friend. And by next week, we're going to be in the Stanley Cup final, and I'm pumped for it. So, good work by you.
Right on, right on.